produce films.
According to Major General Hossein Salami, the chief commander of the IRGC and the keynote speaker of the closing ceremony, the Resistance Film Festival has been able to do a great job in building cultural and artistic bridges between resistance filmmakers and therefore has become a powerful tool of cultural diplomacy with a promising future.
The 17th International Resistance Film Festival has come to an end in the most memorable way, with its participants hoping that they can use cinema to inspire people across the world and promote resistance against oppression. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Asaluye.
Activists gathered in Seoul to protest Japan's plan to begin releasing the radioactive contaminated water accumulating as a result of the Fukushima nuclear disaster. The demonstration comes as the region marks the 12th anniversary of the Fukushima nuclear disaster, with several nations, including China, protesting Tokyo's plan.
Japan's neighbors, including China, South Korea, North Korea, and Russia, as well as Pacific Island countries, have repeatedly expressed concerns and firm opposition to Japan's plan to discharge the nuclear-contaminated wastewater into the sea.
On March 11, 2011, a tsunami flooded the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, causing the meltdowns of three reactors. 150,000 people were evacuated. The disaster caused nuclear-reliant countries to rethink energy policies. Under previous President Moon Jae-in, South Korea had been moving to phase out nuclear energy. Now, under President Yoon Suk-yeol, the country has reversed course with plans to increase nuclear energy production to more than 30% of the total by 2030. South Koreans demonstrating in Seoul oppose the country's return to nuclear energy reliance. South Korea is not only renewing old reactors, but restarting construction on new reactors and building nuclear power plants for other countries.
Energy policies centered on nuclear power are being misrepresented as a solution to the safety of the people and the climate crisis. The lifespan of old nuclear power plants across the country, including Busan Gori No. 1, is being extended without regard for safety, and the region is in danger of becoming a nuclear waste site.
South Korea is developing a nuclear waste problem with existing spent fuel storage set to reach full capacity within 10 years. Frank Smith, Seoul.
After a year spent in Ukraine covering the ongoing conflict with Russia, Italian freelance journalists Andrea Ceresini and Alfredo Bosco returned to Italy a couple of weeks ago on advice of Italy's foreign ministry. The two had their press accreditation suspended by the Ukrainian authorities while they were returning from the Bakhmut front in early February. For weeks, they were unable to work, awaiting interrogation by the Ukrainian security service. Both journalists claim that Kiev's decision was unfounded.
Ukrainian authorities have never explained to us why our press accreditation was suspended. What we know is that both of us carried out independent reports in Ukraine and in the republics of Donetsk and Luhansk between 2014 and 2015. At least two other Italian journalists have received the same treatment. On our Fixers chats, there were talks that we had been collaborating with the Russians, that we were spies. It would have been really dangerous to stay in Ukraine for us.
Some Italian media have reported that at least eight Italian journalists have been blacklisted by the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense over the past weeks. According to the two journalists, Ceresini and Bosco, all of them had reported from the Donbas region in previous years.
We thought a solution could have been found during Italy's Prime Minister Meloni's visit to Kiev last month. We were ready to discuss our situation with the Ukrainian authorities. It goes without saying that we are disappointed.
Andrea Ceresini is an expert on far-right terrorism in Italy's 70s. He has been freelancing for a number of authoritative Italian broadcasters and newspapers from many areas of crisis, including Egypt and Venezuela. Alfredo Bosco established himself for his photo reportage on Mexico's drug cartels and 2010's Haiti's cholera outbreak.
Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has yet to comment on the suspension of the two journalists' press accreditation by the Ukrainian authorities, nor has she ever expressed support for them. Rome has been a staunch supporter of Kyiv since the beginning of the war in Ukraine over a year ago. Max Civili, Rome.
Introducing a new role model by outlining the most important characteristics. The third model for women may be the answer to women's woes, and what better occasion to discuss this global issue than International Women's Day. The concept of the third model for women was presented initially on March 6, 2012, by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. And now academics and researchers participating in an international congress held in Tehran have taken the opportunity to shed more light on this new concept.
In order to present this new role model and to explain its different dimensions, we must allow a scientific discourse to take place. Therefore, we must first theorize the two models that exist, namely the Western narrative of women and the Eastern viewpoint. Then we can create a platform for promoting the third model, which is the Muslim women.
The leader of the Islamic Revolution presented this concept about 10 years ago, and by holding this conference, we want to promote third model for women to the elite in order to design a comprehensive plan of action. We should start with articles, books and meetings, and then we can move forward.
According to the foreign participants of the conference, the issue of the status of women in today's world is a complicated one, and practical examples are necessary to understand the concept. One faculty member in particular raised an interesting point.
In Iran, women clearly play an important role in the society, and women are active in all different aspects of social life. Many of them are known worldwide. So I think that if we're looking for practical examples of this concept, all we need to do is look at the Iranian society.
In the East, traditionally women have been sidelined, and in the West they are mostly exploited for political and economic gains. But Islam presents a different viewpoint.
Iranian women and Iranian Muslim women in particular reflect the teachings of Islam and how Islam defines women. They are active members of the community. This is quite evident in the Iranian society.
Reflecting the true image of Iranian women while highlighting their achievements is a necessary step that needs to be taken.
Ayatollah Khamenei believes that in the Islamic school of thought, women play an exceptional role in the society, and therefore he presents a new and more realistic model. Very different from the Western capitalist and the Eastern sidelined and passive woman. The third model is the Iranian Muslim woman, an active member of the society who has opened a new chapter in history. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
A high-ranking Iranian delegation headed by Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian arrived in Damascus. The top official met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, who welcomed Iran's participation in the upcoming quadripartite talks between Syria, Turkey, Iran, and Russia. Assad asserted that Syrians' interests are the basis for any steps or dialogue the government makes. Amir Abdullahian renewed Iran's support to Syria. He said Iran trusts Syria's stances and decisions and will support them during the quadripartite talks. He also welcomed the recent ease of tensions between Syria and Arab countries. The top official also held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Maqdad, followed by a joint press conference in which Amir Abdullahian underlined that dialogue is the only way to end the region's dilemmas.
We'll continue to support Syria during its hardships. Bilateral talks and dialogue in the region is the only solution for crisis. We will welcome the upcoming quadripartite meetings in Moscow with the aim of increasing cooperation and ending all crises.
He added that the recent Israeli aggression on Aleppo indicates the regime's barbaric attitude and reflects its concern over internal crises Israel is facing. Amir Abdullahian said it is time that all foreign troops illegally present in Syria to leave, calling on all sides to respect Syria's sovereignty. Miqdad, for his part, said coordination between both countries is at its highest levels, describing Iran's role during Syria's unrest as positive.
The role played by Iran in Astana talks in all stages of Syria's crisis was a positive one. That's why, from the beginning, we welcomed Iran's participation in the quadripartite talks. This role always proved Iran's respect of international legitimacy in efforts to end crisis.
Amir Abdullahian also visited earthquake-affected parts of Syria, as well as temporary shelter centers, expressing Iran's condolences to the Syrian people and promising his country will continue to send humanitarian aid to the needy. Iran's foreign minister is exerting diplomatic efforts to speed up the restoration of relations between Syria and Turkey. The ties between Syria and Iran continue to set an example of steadfast strategic cooperation in the region based on trust and mutual interests. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Tens of Palestinians took to the streets after prayer, expressing their support with the Palestinian prisoners and Israeli jails against the repressive measures and policies initiated by the far-right Israeli Minister of National Security, Itamar Ben-Gvir. Thousands of Palestinian political prisoners in Israeli prisons continue for the 22nd day of collective disappearance measures in response to the ongoing repression campaign. Islamic Jihad movement has affirmed its support for the Palestinian prisoners' civil disobedience actions in the face of the Israeli fanatic measures, stressing that the prisoners will never be abandoned.
We declare in the Islamic Jihad that we stand with the Palestinian prisoners and support their civil disobedience actions. And even if the measures escalated to an open-ended hunger strike, we will support them and ready for all the possibilities. We will never abandon them.
On top of these measures is the approval of a draft bill that would authorize the execution of the Palestinian detainees that have performed anti-occupation operations. The campaign is expected to culminate on the first day of the upcoming holy fasting month of Ramadan, with a full-scale hunger strike bearing the banner of freedom or martyrdom. Palestinian prisoner's father expressed his concerns over the hunger strike step, calling for the international organizations to support the prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners' families live in stress over the lives of their sons and daughters in Israeli jails, as hunger strike is the most difficult thing a prisoner can endure, and it threatens their lives.
Palestinians chanted slogans against the far-right Israeli minister Itamar Ben-Gvir and called for the immediate halt of the repressive measures.
Our prisoners' cause is a just one, and we support them in everything they take against the Israeli measures. We call on the world to support the Palestinian prisoners and put pressure on the Zionist occupation to stop passing the law and stop repressive measures against prisoners and detainees.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip stressed that Israel's hostile policies will never stop them from exercising their right to resist the regime and its settlers. Al Al-Asi, Gaza.
This year's International Women's Day has seen the United Nations raising the alarm about the situation of women in Afghanistan. The UNICEF has announced that the number of malnourished, pregnant and breastfeeding women in the country has increased by 49%. According to the UN agency, nearly 3 million women and young girls in Afghanistan suffer from undernutrition.
The current situation of Afghanistan has affected all sections of Afghan society, especially pregnant and breastfeeding women. You know that pregnant and breastfeeding mothers are the most vulnerable. Most of the mother patients we receive nowadays are severely undernourished, which results from acute poverty. People living in the hospital's neighborhood are going through harsh economic conditions.
As the war-torn country is gripped by multiple crises, Afghan women and children are hit the hardest. Doctors and experts emphasize the need for continued relief and for Afghans, especially women.
Undoubtedly, Afghanistan today is dependent on aid, and such assistance is of high importance because they can save lives, especially those of malnourished children and pregnant women. It is better not to politicize the treatment and well-being of mothers and children. I hope donors continue to provide aid to the country's health sector and improve people's conditions.
Most households in Afghanistan are relying on their male breadwinners. In many cases, they fail to make ends meet or provide enough food for their families, as the country has been grappling with an economic crisis, mainly caused by the freezing of Afghan assets by Western countries. The U.S. and its allies have frozen Afghan assets and aid after the Taliban took power in 2021, following the chaotic U.S. withdrawal from the country. This year on International Women's Day, Afghan women are in great distress as they experience rapidly deteriorating conditions. Advocates are calling for greater support and attention for the well-being of Afghan women. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Dozens of people, many fleeing war and persecution, risk their lives every day in makeshift boats crossing the English Channel to seek asylum in the UK. But a new government bill here is about to change that.
People must know that if they come here illegally, it will result in their detention and swift removal. Once this happens, and they know it will happen, they will not come and the boats will stop.
The previous government's so-called Rwanda plan that would see migrants deported to Rwanda has not been implemented after legal challenges from rights groups. The government argues the law will stop the business of people smugglers. The UN has called the bill a clear breach of the Refugee Convention, and rights activists say it is unethical and unworkable.
It's absolutely ridiculous. People will continue to exploit vulnerable people who are desperately trying to flee oppressive regimes, you know, flee from countries where they have no hope, no rights, and no future. People smugglers don't care about processes and procedures and what will happen the other end. They care about collecting their money and making sure boats or trains or whatever pushes out with human cargo on it.
2022 saw a record 25,000 people arriving in the UK by boat. 31 died trying, raising questions about the functionality of the UK's asylum system.
Well, it certainly isn't fit for purpose. It is very, very bureaucratic. But it also takes too long, for instance, give those claiming asylum with the skills and experience that we are very short of here in the United Kingdom.
And then there's Brexit. Before it, the UK shared a returns policy with the EU that allowed it to send migrants back to the countries they had first arrived in. There is no such deal in place now.
The bill is unlikely to face much opposition in the building behind me, where the Conservatives have a majority. But we're yet to see how it'll fare in the Cores. Critics are also saying that it's a gimmick by the government to win more votes among its conservative base at the next general election. Saeed Purza, London.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. Limelight.
A
According to political commentators, bilateral relationship between the United States and China has been set towards further deterioration as competition between the two major world powers continues with no end in sight. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. NBC News has covered this story and tells us more. According to internal documents, a senior U.S. Air Force commander warned his subordinates that they should brace for war with China over Taiwan in just 2 years' time. In a memo obtained by the outlet and confirmed by U.S. officials, General Mike Minahan, the head of the Air Mobility Command, claimed that as both the United States and Taiwan will be distracted by their presidential elections in 2024, Beijing will be able to make a move against the self-governed island. The memo said, "I hope I'm wrong. My gut feeling tells me we will fight in 2025. The document is referred to all wing commanders in Air Mobility Command and other Air Force operational commanders and orders them to report on all major efforts related to a potential standoff with China within 1 month. During the month of February, General Mike Minahan directs all AMC personnel to fire a clip into a 7-meter target with a full understanding that unrepentant lethality matters most. Aim for the head. He also orders all personnel to update their records and emergency contacts. U.S. commanders are also urged not to shy away from risk during drills. General Mike Minahan wrote, "If you are comfortable in your approach to training, then you are not taking enough risks." While an AMC spokesperson confirmed the authenticity of the memo, an unnamed Pentagon official told NBC News that these comments are not representative of the department's views on China. Senior U.S. officials have claimed in recent months that they have evidence China is rapidly accelerating its timeline for taking control of Taiwan. China has sovereignty over Chinese Taipei, and under the One China policy, almost all countries in the world recognize that sovereignty, meaning that they would not establish diplomatic contact with Taiwan's secessionist government. The United States, too, claims commitment to that principle, but in violation of its own stated policy and an attempt to antagonize Beijing, Washington has quartered the secessionist government in Taipei, supporting its anti-China stance and supplying it with large cache of weaponry. Tensions over the self-rule island intensified following a provocative visit there last August by Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House of Representatives at the time. It prompted large-scale Chinese military drills around the island territory, as well as a declaration by U.S. President Joe Biden to defend Taiwan. Beijing says the issue of Chinese Taipei is a red line that must not be crossed. In October, China's President Xi Jinping stated that although Beijing seeks peaceful reunification with Taiwan, it will never promise to give up the use of force and reserves the option to take all necessary measures to achieve this goal. The Fox News Channel has also covered this story and tells us more. U.S. Republican Congressman Michael McCaul has said that with the Democratic President Joe Biden in the White House, the risk of a conflict between China and Taiwan is very high. Congressman Michael McCaul added that the U.S. military is not ready to fight a war with China, and it could run out of precision missiles and advanced technology in less than a week if war breaks out. Congressman Michael McCaul said on Sunday, 29th of January, "We have to be prepared for this, and it could happen, I think, as long as Joe Biden is in office, projecting weakness as he did with Afghanistan, that led to Russia to start its special operation in Ukraine, that the odds are very high we could see a conflict with China and Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific. Michael McCall also said the US could run out of advanced weaponry in less than a week if the United States launched a war with China. A study published by a think tank last week found that the United States would likely run out of some of its munitions, including long-range precision-guided ones, in less than a week if war breaks out with China. The Center for Strategic and International Studies study said that the United States was not adequately prepared for a war with China. The think tank said in its report, the U.S. defense industrial base is not adequately prepared for the competitive security environment that now exists. It is currently operating at a tempo better suited to a peacetime environment. According to the report, the U.S. military aid to Ukraine has depleted the arms stockpiles of the U.S. Department of Defense, the Pentagon, and points to the difficulties the United States industrial base could face in supplying munitions for a major war. Michael McCall lamented, "Our industrial defense base is broken. I signed off on all foreign military weapons sales 3 years ago. They have yet to go into Taiwan. We need that deterrence, but if we don't have the weapons, that's as critical for deterrence." Washington is Taiwan's most important international backer and arms supplier, despite the absence of formal diplomatic relations. U.S. arms sales to Taiwan are a constant irritant to Beijing's relations with Washington, which have rapidly deteriorated in recent years. The Washington Times has also covered this story and tells us more. The newly elected Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Kevin McCarthy, plans to travel to Chinese Taipei in what would renew tensions with China. Media reports say recently the U.S. Defense Department, the Pentagon, was preparing for Kevin McCarthy's visit to Taipei this spring. If McCarthy goes on to travel to Taipei, it would be the second trip to the self-ruled island by U.S. House Speaker in less than a year, sparking almost back-to-back escalation with China, which has sovereignty over Taipei. Former Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan in August of last year, bypassing Beijing diplomatically and establishing direct contact with Taipei to plan the trip. That visit angered China, which issued statements critical of Nancy Pelosi and the U.S. and staged large military exercises in waters near the island to assert its sovereignty. Tensions in the Taiwan Strait reached levels not seen in three decades, with live fire drills in several areas around the island. Kevin McCarthy's possible visit could also waste any gains from a meeting between U.S. President Joe Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping at the Group of 20 summit last November, which was intended to pave the way for improved relations between the two nations after Nancy Pelosi's visit. International relations analysts with Eurasia Group told media that news of Kevin McCarthy's visit to Chinese Taipei was no surprise because the new House Speaker would want to maintain domestic political legitimacy in the face of bipartisan support for aggressive policy towards China. While the Biden administration had reservations about Nancy Pelosi's trip before it took place, the administration ultimately decided against forestalling it. However, analysts at the Eurasia Group agreed that a second official visit by a U.S. House Speaker does represent an escalation of what Beijing sees as U.S. interference in cross-strait affairs, even though Kevin McCarthy, a Republican, may not be seen as representing official White House policy.
This one lay. Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
This is the second largest U.S. bank failure in history. Silicon Valley Bank held $209 billion in assets at the time of its collapse. Even after adjusting for inflation, by assets it trailed only Washington Mutual, which held $434 billion in assets when it failed in 2008 during the U.S. home mortgage crisis, which triggered the world financial crisis. So is the U.S. headed for another financial crisis? What does the failure of this bank say about the state of the U.S. economy? First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Frank Emsbach joins us, emeritus professor, University of Wisconsin in Madison. Also joining us, Clive Menzies, political economy researcher and analyst who joins us from London.
Is the Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Frank Emsbach, let me first start with you. So SVB failing. What are we looking at here? Losses of $1.8 billion in a bond fire sale in which it led to clients to withdraw deposits. What does a $1.8 billion bond fire sale mean? And also looking at how it's not a small bank, 16th largest bank in the country, which held $210 billion in assets.
Well, the bond sale is that the bank was short on cash and so went to the bond market to cash in its bonds to get cash. But everybody said, wait a minute, why are they short on cash? And began looking a little further into the bank's finances. But the issue is not the $1.8 billion. The centrality of this bank is that it is the banker for approximately, according to the New York Times today, 2,500 or so startup companies. And so these companies are high-tech companies of all kinds, many of them in California. And so a company, let's say, is starting up and they're beginning to grow their business and they're crucial to this little, you know, market that they've got. And they put in, they have $4 million deposit in this bank. And this happens. Well, what does that mean? It means the first $250,000 of their money is okay, but the other $3.5 million or $3.75 million is not okay. They can't get to it. So they might not be able to make payroll. They might not be able to pay off other, you know, suppliers. And so what happens here is there is a multiplying effect in a very, very crucial portion of the American economy, which is the high-tech startup portion of the American economy. And that's the importance of this bank.
Sure. Well, having a tough time here understanding, but it's almost something that maybe is somewhat customary looking back at the 2008 financial crisis, Clive Menzies, and that's how a bank, the second biggest one here, can collapse. When the news came out just on Wednesday, they asked for $2.25 billion to shore up their balance sheet, and then there's a run, and here we are. How does that happen?
Well, it happens.
No, Frank, it's for Clive Menzies. I'm sorry. I'll get to you, Frank. Go ahead, Clive.
I think Frank is quite right. You know, this is just a very small trigger or spark for something much bigger. I mean, essentially, we never escaped the 2008 financial crisis, because the way to escape that was that people should have lost a lot of money, but they didn't, and the banking system was propped up. And money is effectively, in this banking system, is our single point of failure. And a failure of the banking system, which dwarfs the real economy, causes real disruption in the real economy. And money is the medium through which the plunder and control has been exercised. So in 2008, the bank bailouts and the TARP relief and the quantitative easing that has happened ever since have been just the issuance of debt to prop up what is effectively a bankrupt banking system. And by September 2008, the Fed started to expand its balance sheet because, again, there was a liquidity crisis in the money markets. And this is what we're talking about today. And the reason there is a liquidity crisis is that the way this money expansion has occurred is through central banks buying back much of the toxic debt which accumulated prior to the 2008 crash. And they have been buying debt instruments ever since. So the whole house of cards is built on very little value. The central banks have been buying at market value, but the market value in no way reflects the real value of the underlying assets. So what we're talking about with this, if you like, domino falling, is the beginning of something much bigger. I mean, the big banks like Deutsche Bank have been bankrupt, but what's shown on their balance sheet has a value that bears no relationship to reality.
But they don't close down. Again, goes back to the question. Let me get to Frank Emspach with the same question. Frank, the second biggest bank in the U.S. going down the way it did, I mean, you would think that the 2008 financial crisis would have been obviously a learning lesson. I mean, where's the SEC? Where's the control? It's not a small bank here.
It's not a small bank, and where the controls are basically the ideology of control is not to control capitalism, but to support it. And so when there is a banking crisis or liquidity crisis caused by other reasons, in this case, an attempt to curb inflation by raising interest rates and increasing unemployment, you know, that's the chosen method. So that creates all kinds of other problems, one of which is that now people can't get cheap money for investment. And so there are questions about the kind of investments now that are being, in this case, 2,500 of them, in the high-tech industry. So the importance of this bank isn't alone that money sort of seems to, like, disappear. The importance is that a major innovative, growing sector of the American economy just got hit in the head because these companies, these smaller companies, do not have resources. They can't suddenly go someplace else if their money is tied up in litigation and get other cash so soon.
Right.
So what you've done here is destabilized a very, very important section of the economy. And we don't know. This is Saturday. So we don't know what's going to happen Monday in terms of many of these firms or other banks.
I think we need some backdrop here, Clive Menzies, when it comes to the point that Frank is making there, because SVB served as one of the primary regional banks when it came to the tech sector and, of course, startups, for example, as Frank indicated there. But we do know is what has happened from the latter half of the year 2022, roughly around September, when you saw mass layoffs. And again, you can give us that backdrop when it came to tech firms like Meta, Amazon, Google, and the likes. What happened? Because we know those layoffs were huge in numbers. And even now, in the first quarter of 2023, we've seen around 50,000 additional employees to have been laid off.
Well, Kevin, there are multiple strands to this. And I think just before I address the tech issue specifically, the tech companies that Frank was describing are what are classified as small to medium-sized enterprises. Now, I mentioned in my last contribution just now that the Fed started expanding its balance sheet in September 2019, and that date is quite important because the COVID psychological operation, as I would call it, was actually instrumental in closing down huge swathes of the small to medium enterprise economy. So not only is the tech sector being affected by this specific banking crisis, but there has been a general assault on any small businesses. And these large companies, the ones that are laying off masses of people, Meta, Microsoft, etc., there are multiple factors at play there, because they are losing the ground to some extent to distributed autonomous organization, which I might go into later if we have time, which is basically a much more distributed way of working. And they recognize that, and with the AI and all the rest of it, they just don't need the people. And this economy is built on the premise of we price labor in terms of supply and demand, but we have an oversupply of labor and a lack of demand, because basically the more labor you can shed, the more money you make. And that's the sort of cold, hard reality of how these companies work. And it's the shareholder value. So that there are many strands, but in essence, Frank is right, that it's a domino effect, that these small companies can't pay their wages. They have suppliers, and it goes on down the chain. And this is against a backdrop of overinflation inflated money supply, which is going to lead to hyperinflation. So you have all these forces, some of which are opposing, some of which are congruent, and it's going to create a great deal of instability. But luckily, there are, if you like, other things emerging that are going to hopefully act as a safety net when everything, for want of a better way of putting it, and excuse my terminology, goes to shit.
Okay. All right. Couldn't be clearer than that. All right. So, Frank Imspach, correct me if I'm wrong. If you're having the types of layoffs, in terms of numbers, I should say, that's happened now up to this point, roughly speaking, it's about 125,000 in a span of about 5 or 6 months, particularly skewed in the tech sector. Isn't that going to affect the U.S. economy? Because that's what I'd like to get into with you and from this half of the program, as to what's going on with the U.S. economy. I mean, roughly 125. Some say it's up to 200,000. Some, I think CNBC was one that reported that it could be up to 200,000. But, I mean, when you have that many layoffs, doesn't that affect the U.S. economy and the supply chains and the consumers who are now out of the economic cycle, perhaps, that are going to be spending the money?
Well, not quite. It might, but here are a couple of different things. First of all, 200,000 people out of the tech sector is not a huge amount, given all the people in the tech sector. That's the first thing. Second thing is, we're not talking about an immediate cutoff of income. Many of these people have various packages for unemployment and separation from their company that last a couple of months. But the importance of this bank failure, that's another issue, because a lot of the people in some of these companies went over or are going over to the increase in employment in the smaller and medium-sized companies, which was fueled by the cheap money. So in a place like the Silicon Valley, where there's hundreds of these companies, as well as the larger ones, there was a safety valve. And that safety valve now may be closed, because these companies are in trouble. So that's one thing. But there are countervailing forces. If we take this area, Madison, Wisconsin, which is a very, very highly concentrated medical high-tech community, Epic just announced that they were going to hire 1,800 more people on top of the 7,000 they've got here in the suburbs of Madison. So, you know, there are still different factors, different sectors of the economy that are growing. And, of course, we now have what's going to be another infusion in the tried way in which the United States has dealt with unemployment and whatnot, the Keynesian method of defense spending. There's a 4-point-some-odd% increase in the defense spending. There are increasing demands and cries to the defense industry to hire people to supply the war in Ukraine. And so there's going to be a big push in that direction. So I think there are some countervailing forces. Now, we'll see if there are enough. But the fact of the matter is that the area that's going to be most affected is going to be this high-tech sector. But 250,000 people, although it sounds like a lot, and it's certainly not good news, is not the kind of thing that will destabilize the economy. What's going to destabilize the economy is if a couple of these other banks that are related in the same economic sector as this bank, if okay. they begin to falter on Monday, then we're in a different situation.
Well, Clive Menzies, when you take a look at the way that COVID came and the money that the U.S. spent, it is said it's about $1.5 trillion, okay? Given the money that was spent and the return that the U.S. is getting, when you take a look at the U.S. GDP, it's not getting that much of a return back. Isn't that indicative of a U.S. economy that's not on steady foot?
I think that presupposes that American policy had anything to do with bank bailouts and COVID and all the rest of it. That was all driven by the people who were the beneficiaries of all this debt's being created. I mean, the banking system is driving everything, the people who control money. So, no, they didn't get much of a return. But, you know, nor did anyone else. This has been an assault globally. And what we're talking about, as I've discussed before on your programs, is a structural issue. We have some fundamental flaws in our structure, and there is no way out of this other than to change the structure as to how we organize ourselves. And what underpins that structure is money, which I described as a single point of failure. And what is emerging to take its place is a very different way of handling value, which is already being capitalized on by Amazon, Google, because they're using our data and they are making huge amounts of money out of it. Well, what is going to shift is that instead of having that data value harnessed and harvested by relatively few small companies, which cumulatively Apple, Amazon, and I think Google are worth something like $15 trillion, that is going to dissipate into something called distributed autonomous organization. Open source created the internet, and it is creating the same environment for money or value. It's yet to be applied to money, but it will be. Money methodology will change, and that is the way the transition will occur. But the existing framework of continually creating more and more debt in order to keep this bicycle upright, sooner or later fails. That's why we have debt jubilees and bank failures every few decades. And arguably, we should have had the mother of all bank failures in 2008. What they're desperately trying to do with the Great Reset and all the other measures they're trying to do is come up with a digital replacement that will try and, if you like, anesthetize the economy from all this debt. But it ain't going to work. And so this distributed autonomous organization is what will emerge to take its place.
Okay.
But I can give you a time horizon on that.
All right. We also need to touch a little bit about what you talked about, that open chat, which is a phenomenon in itself. All right. So, Frank, you talk about how we have to wait until Monday to see how other banks are doing. Isn't that a worrying sign that we have to take, that we have to wait? I mean, really, which camp are you in? Because there's two different takes about this collapse that has happened. One saying that contagion is going to happen. Other banks are sure to either go bankrupt or stop operations, however way you want to term it. And the others that say, no, banks actually are in a good financial standing, and that's not going to happen. So where does it stand?
Well, I think it partially depends on the bank and their business. And I don't have, you know, in my head, a encyclopedic knowledge of all these major banks. All right. I think that it stands. Yes, it's worrisome. The fact that you were sitting around on Saturday and you've got 2,500 small businesses who've desperately tried to move their money from the Silicon Valley Bank to other banks so they can operate on Monday morning. You know, they're the ones who are worried. And of course, observing this and reading, you know, the tales of woe in the paper about this and that company who's had a quarter of, you know, millions of dollars, now they can't get it. Of course it's worrying. And yes, it's disturbing that you should have the most powerful economic system in the world waiting for 24 hours to see if there's going to be a collapse. Obviously, there's a problem. The fundamental problems, though, are that the Federal Reserve says, well, we're going to solve inflation by attacking working people, by increasing employment and raising interest. Well, what do you think is going to happen? What's going to happen is that money available to startups is going to become more expensive, and they're going to be looking around for other ways to deal with it. And so you begin to undermine that industry. And that's what's happened here. They began to go to the SVG and say, we need more cash. SVG is looking around and said, well, all right, gee, we're a little short. Sell the bonds. And oh, my God, why are you short on cash? What's going on over there? And so you have these contradictory effects. Yes, we put in a tremendous amount of money. The American government put in $1.some-odd trillion. To what? To a social safety net, fundamentally, that had been underfunded for a quarter of a century. Okay, and so what we did is we reached the minimum standard that most people in the developed world had for 18 months, incidentally. It's all gone away now. So we're not talking about an investment in productive efforts in this COVID business. You know, we're talking about making good on a quarter of a century of unpaid debt, in a certain sense, to people. Now, in the last year or so, Biden and his advisors saying, geez, we gotta do something. We're losing the productivity battle, something major. So these things are all happening at once.
Sure.
And I think are mutually contradictory and hence very, very difficult of solution.
There's so many points you raised there. My mind just stopped, I think, halfway through what you said. So I apologize for that. Let's try to make some sense out of what was said there, Clive Menzies. And one phrase that stood out of what Frank said was how the Fed is attacking the people. And then, of course, he went on with a further explanation of that. What is going on with the Fed when it comes to interest rates, when it comes to a job report that indicates there's lots of jobs that have been filled, but that's not what the Fed really wants? It wants to cool down the inflation, and the rosy job output there is not good news for the U.S. economy. Perhaps that needs a bit of explanation, if you can, Clive Menzies.
Briefly, because there's a much bigger explanation, but in essence, as I've said on this program before, money rules, and the banking system comprises central banks and commercial banks, and they create all the money, they create all the debt, and they run the financial system. And in running the financial system, they run all the other levers of power. Governments do not rule. The money system has access to all the levers of power, including government, but or commerce. And as I say, it's a much bigger conversation. As far as the other piece of Frank's conversation, where he was talking about what was going to happen on Monday, and he said it depends on the state of the balance sheet and the business type of the other banks. In essence, banking is a confidence trick. Basically, you sign a piece of paper for a loan and they give you money in return. And as long as everybody has confidence,